Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments Podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor for Neurology Live. In this episode, we're going to continue our busy month of June by recapping the recent Sleep 2022 annual meeting with some snippets of conversations that we had with a couple of experts while we were in Charlotte. Let's dive in. First up, we've got Afsara Zahid, a graduate student at the University of Michigan who spoke to a study that she conducted that examined longitudinal patterns identified in those with difficulty initiating sleep and their associations with memory trajectories among those of different races and genders. Here's what she had to say.
So the inspiration for this project, really, there's a growing body of research, I want to say over the last 10, 15 years, identifying insomnia as a potential modifiable risk factor for dementia and just different cognitive aging outcomes in general. But a lot of that research has been done concurrently looking at insomnia and cognition kind of at the same time, or just looking at insomnia at one snapshot in time and then cognition later. And we know from just decades of research that both sleep and sort of neurodegeneration or cognition can be bidirectional. So I think my inspiration for this project, one of them, was to understand how the chronicity of insomnia and different patterns of insomnia might be related to memory impairment or just memory trajectories over time in older adults. And then a second aim is, you know, we know that there are established disparities or inequalities in the prevalence of dementia and the burden of dementia across gender sort of identities as well as racial and ethnic identities. And something that I think is really interesting is that we also see some of those same disparities in sleep health. And so I was curious to then understand, you know, are we seeing similar sort of patterns or different patterns across different race, gender sort of identities and trying to really understand how we can use this information for intervention work in the future. So insomnia is very heterogeneous of a disorder. It presents very differently. And so rather than looking at kind of insomnia as it's clinically defined, which can be very variable, I really honed in on the symptom of having trouble falling asleep or difficulty initiating sleep, which is DIS. Since prior research, my own work in my dissertation, but also work by some other researchers using different data sets, suggests that insomnia symptom specifically may be related to greater risk for neurodegeneration or cognitive problems later in life. And so I just wanted to kind of continue that work to see if we're seeing a similar signal. And so when I'm looking at chronicity in this project, I'm looking at people who over 4 years, older adults who are reporting no to very minimal trouble falling asleep. Some folks, you know, report having trouble falling asleep most of the time. 1 year, 2 years later, not so much, and then 2 years later after that, it's kind of back. So I would categorize those people as the intermittent DIS group, and then the persistent folks are the ones who, across 4 years, are saying, I have trouble falling asleep, you know, kind of most of the time. And so the primary results from my study really found that it was the folks with the intermittent DIS pattern showing lower subsequent memory compared to those who reported not having that problem. And that's a little bit unexpected because I would expect that the more persistent DIS pattern would be more detrimental for health. But that was one of the findings. I'm not, you know, working as a physician or seeing, you know, patients kind of regularly, but as a, you know, my training is in clinical psychology. I think it is important for these disorders that can present differently among people to look a little bit more closely than just looking at, you know, the category of insomnia versus, you know, not insomnia, just because it can present differently. And so I think looking at it more fine-tunedly in terms of, like, are we looking at trouble falling asleep versus, you know, people who have trouble waking up at night, that might give us ideas towards the mechanism that's linking that symptom to a health outcome. So I think it is important to look at it in that way from that regard. I think it also has implications then for treatment. So, you know, someone who's having difficulty initiating sleep, that might be due to anxiety or stress or sort of other things that can be, for example, treated with cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Versus if they're showing a different insomnia symptom, you know, a different treatment mechanism just might be more appropriate. And so I think looking a little bit more nuanced, and it's almost moving into the direction of like precision medicine, but I think it's helpful from a sort of intervention output, yeah.
Next, we're going to hear from Dr. Richard Bogan, an associate clinical professor at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine and the Medical University of South Carolina, who talked to us about two analyses he presented at Sleep 2022 that reported on the impact of JZP-258, or Xywave, on idiopathic hypersomnia treatment. Here's Dr. Bogan.
Yeah, the data, obviously, this was a very nice study design because it had an open label component, so we had a chance to actually prescribe the medication, adjust the dose to an optimal dose, and then we had that randomized controlled trial component with placebo controlled. And we looked at sleepiness, excessive sleepiness, based on the Epworth score. And these people are pretty sleepy. Their Epworth scores were 15, 16, you know, and then when we put them on medication, some of them were on stimulants. We allow them in, you know, wakefulness promoting medications if they've already been prescribed those and they were stable and they were still sleepy. So you have to always take that into account in terms of the analysis. But their Epworth scores are 15, 16. My Epworth score is 6, 5, maybe 6. I'm a night owl. But these folks, over weeks as we titrated, had improvement in the Epworth score, and that was the primary endpoint. We also looked at a scale called the Idiopathic Hypersomnia Severity Scale. This was designed and validated in Europe and is very specific for this particular disorder. And we know, for example, a score above 27 is clinically relevant, probably idiopathic hypersomnia, and it looks at different components. Those components include, you know, what is your sleep like? How long do you sleep? How hard is it to awaken? How sleepy are you in the daytime? How does it affect you in terms of your functional capacity? And we actually had a scale that looked at sleep inertia because these individuals have a hard time waking up. It also talks about napping. But it's a very specific scale, and these individuals had a high score. They were up, I think, around 37 at the beginning. And you could be 50 is maximum, but we never see a 50. But these people were clearly markedly abnormal. And so we tracked that over a period of time, and what we saw was a drop in that. I can't remember the exact results, but it was right around 15 or 16 when they reached a stable dose, and then we randomized them to placebo. And the placebo group, they were on placebo over 2 weeks, and they got sleepy, and the IHSS score got worse again, indicating that they had worsening of their sleepiness. And then we asked them, we used a term called the patient global impression of change, and how severe are you, and how much did you change? And that also, 88%, I think, of the placebo group got worse. And 20-something percent of the people on Xywave said they got some worse. So clearly a signal, statistical signal. Yeah. So all of those were really impressive enough, I think, that we were impressed clinically. And, of course, the FDA used that data to approve the drug. So now we have the first drug approved to treat idiopathic hypersomnia. So I think there are several points. Obviously, Xyrem, sodium oxybate, has been a good drug. It was approved by the FDA to treat EDS and cataplexy, both in pediatric populations, 7 and above, and the adult population. But the sodium content was pretty high, and in fact, if you were on a dose, you could be, a lot of our patients from 7.5 to 9 grams in divided doses, and that can be as high as 1.6, north of 1.6 grams per day. That's a lot of sodium. And we have concerns about that, obviously. Patients with narcolepsy are not only sleepy and may have cataplexy if they're type 1, but they also have comorbidities. They have a higher prevalence of cardiovascular disease. We're not really quite sure exactly what's going on there. Some of them are obese, some of them are taking medications, but observational data tells us that these folks are at higher risk of cardiovascular disease and hypertension. 70%+ have disrupted nocturnal sleep, interestingly enough. And when we sleep, you know, our body temperature drops, heart rate drops, blood pressure drops. We call it dipping. And sleep is very important for sort of turning down the autonomic tone, kind of lowering the adrenaline level, I tell my patients. And people with narcolepsy don't dip as a group. So we think that creates medical risk. And looking at that observational data, we have concerns about the sodium intake. And Xywav is a calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium oxybate. It's the same moiety, same concentration. So, but by taking Xywav, 92% less sodium. So you're going to reduce your sodium load daily by 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams by switching to the drug. But you know, I take to mind the fact that the FDA said that this is a clinically superior drug. It's a safer drug. It has lower sodium, and it's still oxybate, same active moiety. And we now have clinical experience with the drug in terms of transitioning patients from Xyrem to Xywav, the lower sodium moiety. And most people, it's gram for gram. It's fairly easy. The patients understand, I took 4.5 grams, I took 7.5, not many people take 4.5, but 7.5 grams or 9 grams of Xyrem, I'll take the same amount of Xywav. And so it's fairly easy. And we're always tweaking, so there are always some. So if you look at the narcolepsy trial, for example, where we transitioned people from Xyrem to Xywav, almost the majority stayed on the same dose. But we tweaked a few of them, but it was still within 1.5 grams of the Xyrem dose.
Finally, we're going to close things out this week with a snippet of our conversation with Dr. Ruth Benka, the professor and chair of psychiatry and human behavior at the Wake Forest School of Medicine, who talked with us about the current understanding of the associations between sleep disorders and the risk of dementia. Here's Dr. Benka to close us out.
Well, first of all, I'm going to talk about how prevalent sleep problems are in patients with Alzheimer's disease, and they're much more severe than in either older people without Alzheimer's or younger adults who have insomnia problems. So it's a much more complicated problem because as we age, and particularly for people with Alzheimer's, their sleep apparatus doesn't work as well. They have disruptions of circadian rhythms, and sleep problems are highly problematic in this population. So most patients with Alzheimer's will have some sort of sleep issues, either not being able to stay asleep at night, sleeping inappropriately during the day, or both. And what we know is that the sleep problems that these patients have are correlated or associated with other problems that they're having. So they have more behavioral problems, their cognitive problems are worse, they have more depression and anxiety. So it's really the sleep problems sort of go along with a lot of the other problems that Alzheimer's patients have. So there's that impact. And then, of course, sleep problems in an Alzheimer's patient are going to impact on their caregivers if they're at home. Because if the patient's not sleeping at night, the caregiver isn't sleeping at night. And what we have found in reviewing the literature is that probably the biggest problem for caregivers is the nocturnal wanderings at night that patients have. And finally, there are a lot of, so the other impact for patients is if they have a lot of sleep disturbances and particularly aren't able to remain in bed and asleep at night, it leads to a greater risk of institutionalization, which is also very costly and often not really desired by anybody. But sleep problems also affect the caregivers, I think a lot of studies have shown. So if the Alzheimer's patients aren't sleeping well, their caregivers tend not to be sleeping as well either because they're having to get up a lot. They have more anxiety and depression, and both the patients and caregivers' quality of life suffers as a result. I think it probably isn't discussed as much although you know, we're increasingly trying to figure out how can we help caregivers. One of the things that I just wanted to bring up, and one of the topics that's being discussed a lot at this meeting, is not only that patients with Alzheimer's have sleep problems, but that sleep problems are highly predictive of increased risk for developing Alzheimer's and more rapid progression of Alzheimer's. So that's another factor. I think one of the things is that sleep problems are often the first symptom. It's a very early symptom, and it may occur prior to cognitive problems and mood problems. And we know in people in general, even in kids as well as adults, that people who have more sleep problems and more insomnia are more likely to develop mood problems. And mood problems are also common in Alzheimer's patients. So what we think is that there's a progression of, for example, with insomnia and mood issues, and that we now are understanding more about the functions of sleep, and that sleep is very important for clearing abnormal substances like amyloid and tau, which are involved in Alzheimer's disease, and clearing those from the brain during sleep. So sleep problems can contribute to that. We also know that obstructive sleep apnea is a risk factor, and that may be also because of its effects on cerebrovascular disease, as well as, of course, disrupting sleep and maybe impacting clearance of Alzheimer's toxins from the brain. So we're still trying to understand that as well.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.